just a minute.
Learning how to have a rest is an essential modern life skill. Mindfulness is a technique. Meditation is a tool. Come share the wisdom and resolve conflict at the 9th Global Conference on Buddhism, Perth Convention Centre, 8th and 9th of August. Tickets from $50. Visit 9gcb.org.
Okay, very good. Since last Friday night and last weekend, I've been travelling again, going over to Indonesia for a big conference of Buddhist nuns. It was the Sakyadita. They invited me over there to help out. And it was a very weird experience for me, because for years and years and years, being a Theravada Buddhist monk, there's always been lots and lots and lots of monks around. But for the first time, I was at this conference, and there were just nuns. I was the only monk there, which was weird. But I did have one advantage, because I always look at the positive side of things in life. And one advantage was that I never had to queue for the toilet. I was one of the only male people there. Those poor old nuns were queuing up, but me, there's no one in there. I was the only male hanging out with the nuns. But one of the things, obviously, I came back with a bit of a cold, a bit of a sniffles, and just working a bit hard. But this is just what you have to do in life. Even monks work very hard. But looking for a topic of the talk this evening, I was reminded of a little saying, which was one of the little sayings on the T-shirts, which we printed some years ago. And that was, don't worry, everything's out of control. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. Because usually people say, don't worry, everything is under control. And that is one of the biggest lies in the world. As a monk, I have to tell the truth. And it is out of control. And it's wonderful that it's out of control. And in fact, it's the most beautiful thing in the world that life is out of control, which means how it evolves naturally rather than being created and caused by some powerful being, whether that's your boss or your control freak husband or parent or whatever. Life evolves, and the less control we have, the greater happiness, the greater interest. Life becomes far more pleasant when we stop controlling and let go. So this is not so much about meditation, but life in general. So why are there so many control freaks in the world? And you probably know one. Hope they're not sitting next to you. But probably in your office. And I can understand that this is bad business model to have control freaks. You don't get the best out of your staff if you're a control freak. You know that because you've had control freaks trying to make you work harder, give you more work, shout at you, make you afraid. Does that work? And the other type of boss is kind to you and caring and does nice things to you. And you actually work harder for them. You enjoy the work, more motivation, more energy, which means you get much higher quality work done. You've experienced that, you know, in a place like your office, in your workplace, because I think you all know that that is one of the most important parts of our life. Yeah, we have our family life, we have our weekend life, but we also have the time we have in work. And that we spend so much, a huge proportion of our life at our jobs. If that is not a high quality experience, there's a lot of our life which is just sucks and causes so much stress, so much problems, so much difficulties. And as for me, I've learned, I was been under control freaks before. You know, some monks, I don't know why they, well actually I do know why they do that, I'm going to explain why people actually want to control others and tell them what to do. It does not work. So I'm going to go back to, no, because you haven't stayed in monasteries, I've lived my life in monasteries. You go back to sort of your workplace. What is it like if you've got a boss who's called the boss from hell? Do you really do high quality work for them? Or do you just resent all the stuff they ask you to do? That type of boss creates a lot of staff turnover. People leave, they transfer, go to another job. It's unpleasant, stress levels go up, health goes down, and your family life suffers as well. And I always like quoting this example. Sometimes these examples, there's only a few of them, and you always keep the best ones. I haven't got a better one. The example of this engineering firm in UK many years ago who won a prize for best business practice that year. I often quote this in business conferences. Still remember the name of the company, Farrelly and Sons. It was an engineering company which did building maintenance in some of these high-rises. And they said that in 12 months they tripled their turnover, doubled their profits, and staff turnover went to zero. With a very simple change in philosophy in their company. Imagine that, 12 months, trebling your turnover, doubling your profits. And the simple idea was they banned all overtime. It was totally forbidden according to company policy. You had your hours which you had to work. At the end of the day, the project was finished or not, who cares, you go home. Which meant people went home on time so they could be with their family and be nurtured, you know, by having a good family experience. They could relax when they got back home. Before, when they're doing overtime, they're coming back late, tired, stressed, not enough time to speak with their kids, to look after their partner, to have dinner together and just relax. And because of those family problems, they wouldn't sleep well at night. They'd go to work thinking about the kids not doing well at school because they didn't have enough time with their parents, thinking about their partner who was having a lot of difficulty with them. Their family problems interacted with their productivity at work. Their productivity at work went down, and so the whole thing was just a mess. Just because working too hard, stressed out, not having time to rest, relax, be with their family, to have these important parts of life. It's not just what you eat makes you healthy, it's how you live also makes you healthy. And your emotional life, which is especially nurtured in a family. If you don't have time with them, you get sick. Too many problems, too many difficulties. So this company, simple thing, no overtime. So everybody went home to their family. Family life just was really blossoming. No problems, nurturing, nice sleeps at night. They went back to work on next morning, fresh. So their brain would work efficiently. I always keep saying it's not how long you work at the office or in your job, it's the efficiency of your use of your time. We waste time so much. Especially if you have other problems, you worry about that at work. How can you be focusing on the project in your office or in your job and be worrying about your family at the same time? It just takes up too much of your attention. You're not on the job, which means you don't really produce good work. So it all tends to fall apart. And their productivity went up in the office. They got more work done. And more importantly, in any company, in any business, especially in the monk business, not monkey business, monk business, it's like all about relations. It's connecting with you guys. It's being kind, feeling that you're welcome. That is one of the strengths of our Buddhist society. Why we've got such a vibrant Buddhist society here in Western Australia. There's nothing like this at all in Melbourne and Sydney. Nothing at all which can actually even come close to this Buddhist society in Western Australia. That's why some people go over to Melbourne and Sydney and Queensland and say, where can we find a nice temple like this over east? You can't. Honest. I've been over there. And the reason is because we really want to forge those social values as well, so you feel welcome. This is what has made our company, our Buddhist society, very popular and very successful. And of course, in a business, you do need that friendship, that warmth, which, you know, to your clients, to your suppliers, that counts for a huge amount in business success. And so when they sort of stop controlling their workers by saying, no, off, go home. But they were kind to them. Staff turnover went to zero. No one wanted to leave a company like that, which they were showing they cared for you. And number two, profits went up. Really successful. That wasn't control freak company. That was the opposite, the kind company. And I mention that because it works. Because the reason why people are control freaks is because they are afraid. Afraid of what might happen if they didn't take control. That company would go bankrupt. If I didn't shout at my workers, they wouldn't produce the work. If I didn't ensure that they were there on time in the morning, if I didn't put all the CCTV cameras in the office to check they were there, they'd probably be off somewhere else. What type of culture, society have we created now? Fear-based, control-based. And that's infected our family life, home life, even religious life. One of the wonderful things which I discovered about Buddhism was the fear factor wasn't there. You weren't supposed to be controlled. It wasn't like, if you don't go to the busy bee tomorrow, you will go to hell, you will burn. Which in this cold weather is actually quite attractive. We don't have that fear factor here because we're not trying to control you. That's why you don't even take your names, you know, when you come in here. So everyone is welcome, and you can come, you can go, you don't have to be afraid. You don't have to be sometimes people ask me, what's the etiquette when you come to the temple? Whatever you want to make it to be. And sometimes people say, hang on, Ajahn Brahm, can you actually make it? I want to know what to do, I don't want to offend you. People have been trying years to offend me. They haven't succeeded yet. I've had stones thrown at me. I've had people... Oh, this is a good old story. Here we go. Years and years and years and years and years ago, when our vehicle was an old VW, you know the old VW buses, the combi vans. And I was, don't know where I was going, but it was along the old Leech Highway in the middle of summer, 40 degrees, no aircon in the car. We couldn't afford that. It was just an old bomb of a car, but amazing how well it worked. And because we prayed for it every day, so that made sure it didn't break down. And... had the windows open, and came to one of the intersections, I don't know where, so you know, about three-lane highway, and we were on one line at the red light, and another car of young kids, maybe 19, 20-year-olds, they pulled up in the car next to us, you know, just that age of boys, and they saw there were these monks in the car. I was actually quite proud, at least they knew we were monks. And this is, I know why, because they got out a magazine. And I was in the passenger seat with the window open. And they were just maybe a couple of feet away. And this guy was calling at me with his mouth open, with the magazine open. Ah, look at this, look at this, look at this. It was a copy of Playboy. That's how I knew that they knew we were monks. They're trying to offend me, trying to upset me, trying to wind me up. And of course, what did I do? I just laughed my head off. I thought, what a wonderful joke that is. If I was a young man and if I saw a mic, that's probably what I'd have done as well. I thought it was very funny. So they couldn't offend me, so we all drove off laughing. I know people sometimes ask me, Ajahn Brahm, honestly, did you look? And when I say no, they say, well, how do you know it's Playboy? Because my driver looked. And that's the story I'm sticking to. But that's why you can't be offended here. Oh, this one story, another story, just doing stories. Sometimes it's nice not to plan these talks, let them just evolve. I'm not controlling my talk this evening, so I might go off in all different ways. I just always remember, just over in that corner, I think I told this a couple of weeks ago, but here we go again. Over in the corner over there, there was someone during the meditation laid down, pointed their feet at the Buddha, went to sleep, and started snoring. Now, if there's anything which is against the etiquette of this place, that's it. Breaking so many rules of etiquette. And it was so much that people sitting next to her, you know, woke her up, come, point your foot in another direction. Just, you know, sort of sit up. Don't, if you're going to lay down, at least don't snore, disturb other people. And that's when, you know, when they did that, I changed the title of my talk. I forget what it was, but I mentioned, said that poor lady was a victim of very gross sexual abuse. No, domestic abuse, sorry. Having enormous problems with her husband, violence. In those days, we didn't have so many information and places you can go, people you could ring to solve those problems. This poor lady was just hadn't slept for days. And she came in this room here on a Friday night, and she felt, for the first time in weeks, safe. And she just lay down, quite naturally, went to sleep. In the first time in weeks, she had a safe place to relax. And when I told people that, then they understood what etiquette is. Compassion, kindness, not all these rules and regulations which are supposed to control you. Compassion is supposed to be sensitive to the time and place, to the environment, to let it go, for goodness sake. Just like those guys showing the playbook, they're just having fun, they're just guys. I'd have done the same, you'd have done the same. It's just like sometimes, oh, he's not here this evening, he usually comes on a Friday night. Some of these people I've known for such a long time, my generation, you know them. And when they have kids, I love telling their kids what their father did, what they really did. I did that to my brother once. I was visiting him. He had, you know, a son and a daughter. They're about, you know, 6 and 8 or something. And I, my brother was doing something else in his house. And I started talking about to my nephew and niece what my brother got up to when he was their age, all the naughty things he did. And they were really fascinated. Tell us some more about our dad, because he never tells us that. And then he came into the room. He said, "What are you telling my children? I've been doing all these years trying to teach them not to do those things," which he did himself. And I knew because I was there at the time. So it was what I was teaching those kids, don't try and control people so much. Inspire them. That's the way we sort of encourage people and get people to be much better, to love them, care for them. Those are the rules of etiquette. And so sometimes we have all these rules of etiquette, just makes people so afraid and tense, they don't even want to come into a place like this. They're afraid. This is a religion. They have this idea of religion as being some of the biggest control organizations in the world. You know, controlling your marriage, who you can marry. And if you don't marry the right person, you can't come and do the marriage in this center. You know, controlling just, you know, all of your ethical choices. Have you ever noticed, if you come here long enough and you've actually understood some Buddhism, we never ever tell you what to do. We advise you, give you some guidance so you can make that decision for yourself. It's a path of empowerment, not of control. And when you get that idea, empowering people rather than controlling them, not telling them what to do and punishing them with excommunication, scoldings, having to do penances, all that sort of rubbish. We don't have that. We have encouragement. We don't just leave you alone just to stumble through life on your own, making too many mistakes. Oh, you can come and learn some wisdom teachings, which you can take home with you, which means that you become wiser, but not out of fear, out of kindness. That is the way, instead of control. We're not afraid when people make mistakes. Have you ever noticed that when people are afraid, that's when control comes in? And when it's control, that's when you make the mistakes. You're afraid of making the mistakes, you control, and then you make the mistakes. It's just so obvious to someone like myself. I was supposed to just come back from overseas, supposed to go overseas again in 2 or 3 weeks for a little conference of meditation masters in Korea. But I just found out yesterday that conference, which poor old Korean monk spent so much time and energy organizing it, has been cancelled because of the MERS epidemic in South Korea, on a Middle East respiratory system. And I thought, that's so much overreaction. I know there's about 160 people have been infected by MERS over in Korea. What's the population of Korea? It's actually a big country. I don't know, maybe is it, say, 50 million? Sorry? 40? Any advance on 40? 48? Do I hear 49? Do I hear 50? I don't know, it's roughly about 45 million, say. 45 million people. 100 and say 200 people have got SARS. So, not SARS, MERS, sorry. Let's get it wrong. So 200 out of 45 million. So that's one in five, was it one in 200,000 chance of getting, no, more than that, is it? 200, yeah, that's about one in 200,000 chance of getting MERS. I'll take those odds any day. One in 200,000. Why are people so afraid? Because of fear, that's where we get control. Because of control, that's why we don't have any happiness. Our immune system goes down and we get these diseases. I was always influenced when I was a student. I read widely. And one of the authors I read, you know, just because he was weird, was Edgar Allan Poe, if you know him. He did these really weird, you know, almost sadistic, demented, kinky little novels about the pit and the pendulum. That was one of my favorite ones. Where they had this big pendulum, this big knife going backwards and forwards, and every time it swung, it got an inch lower and an inch lower and an inch lower, and this poor guy was, you know, tied underneath, getting lower and lower and lower and lower and lower. Really weird ideas this guy had. That's why. But he was actually quite a famous author. He was innovative in what he did. Very exciting. Some of his novels, well written. But the one I remember was The Mask of the Red Death, a novel he wrote. And to understand what was happening in Europe in the Middle Ages, was it 1500, 1600, there were so many of these plagues which decimated, literally, I think, wiped out more than half of the population of Europe, even more than that, I think. My history is a bit gone now. But in this little novel, he was actually going back to the idea which people had in those days, that these diseases were caused by demons, these evil spirits who would actually do this on purpose. And in his little novel, they had the meeting of all these demons. And this was a part I thought, this fellow is onto something, this Edgar Allan Poe. Because they had the demon who went to Paris. And in this forest, they always reported on how many they've killed. They said, how many did you kill? He said, I killed 500. For Berlin, I killed 600. London, I killed 400. Paris. And they all compared. And then there was one of the demons. He said, I forget where I was, say in Rome. He said, I only killed 200, but fear killed 2,000. And when I saw that, I said, wow, now that is really powerful. When it's diseases, the disease of MERS will kill so many, but fear will kill twice as many, at least, if you understand what I'm talking about. The fear makes you tense. The tension is bad for your health. You make mistakes because you're not relaxed. That is why we have the problems. Control is bad for your health. And it's also bad for your spiritual growth. It's bad for your families. How many of you are in a relationship where you feel controlled by your partner? What does that feel like? That really sucks. It's not a really beautiful relationship at all. But why does a partner control you? They're afraid. They mix up fear with love. Well, I'm caring for you. I don't want you to get hurt. That is not love. That is fear. And of course, you know what happens then? The relationship just busts. What they're afraid of happening occurs. I've seen that too often. I'm a monk, okay? I don't have a relationship with girls or boys or anybody. I have a relationship with all of you. But I've seen this, just how the thing you're afraid of, because of fear, you make happen. You're afraid of this person leaving you. So you control them, monitor their moves, and they feel so stifled, so imprisoned in the relationship, they can't stand it and they leave. The thing you're afraid of, you make happen. And I also remember just this other little story. It's a classic old story. I wrote about it in the first book, Open the Door of Your Heart, which was the story of when I was a kid growing up, and as a teenager, young man, I was a Buddhist, but it was so hard to see anything which was Buddhist. Buddhist books, Buddhist talks, especially anything Buddhist on the TV. And the only thing which was remotely Buddhist was, you know, the beginning of that TV series, Kung Fu, if ever you remember that one. And because it was supposed to be a Buddhist monk and Buddhist training in China, you know, I still remember one of my teachers saying, this is Buddhist, why is there always a fight in every episode? Which is a valid point. But I would watch that because it was the only thing remotely Buddhist on the TV at the time in England in 1972 or 3 or something. And I remember one episode. I'll always remember this because this taught me actually the nature of fear. And that was when they, if you know the characters, if you haven't seen this, the characters, which is so many years ago now, over 40 years ago, the two main characters was the master, the old Buddhist master who was blind, but just old and incredibly wise. And his young disciple, this little novice, maybe 9, 10, 11 years of age, called Grasshopper. If you remember Grasshopper, that was his nickname. So little Grasshopper and the wise old master. And of course, the master had to train, you know, the disciple. How did he train him? Not by controlling him, telling him what to do, but just inspiring him, advising him, nurturing him through life experiences. And this particular episode, which I will never forget, was when the master took little Grasshopper into this room in the back of the temple, which was always kept locked. For the first time, Grasshopper was invited into this secret temple room. And it was dark with no windows or very few windows. So it took a while before a little Grasshopper could actually see what was in there. And of course, me watching on the TV, you know, it was dark for me, first of all. And then, of course, they put up the lights and you could actually see. And I asked Grasshopper, what do you see, little Grasshopper? What do you see? He said, I see like a pool, like a swimming pool. Go a little bit closer, little Grasshopper. And tell me what you see in the bottom of that pool. And of course, I could see on the TV as well. As little Grasshopper said, I see bones in the bottom of that pool. Human bones in the bottom of that pool. And it started to get scary. And the blind man said, don't go too close, Grasshopper, because that is not water. That is acid, concentrated acid. And those bones are of little novices like you who have fallen in the past decades. And I don't want your bones to join them. Stand back. And what else do you see? And there was a plank going from one side of the pool to the other. I see a plank, Master, I see a plank. Yes, Grasshopper. In 7 days' time, we will give you a test. You will have to walk across that plank from one end to the other over the pool of concentrated acid. And that, I was in a home in London, and even I started to get scared. You know what it's like on TV? They really suck you in. I'm perfectly safe. I'm not walking over any acid, but my friend, little Grasshopper, was. And he said, come outside. And outside, in the sunlight, which was much more sort of comforting, there was another plank, exactly the same length and size, but put on two bricks in the temple courtyard. Now, little grasshopper, you don't have to do any other duties for the next 7 days. No chanting, no nothing. All you need to do is practice your balance. Walk across this plank, because in 7 days' time, you will have to walk over the pool of burning, lethal acid. And so, little grasshopper was walking across this plank in the courtyard, no problem at all. You could do it blindfolded, dancing, hopping, whatever. It's just an ordinary plank, no problem. But when it came the time for the big test, the master took little grasshopper into the dark and spooky, frightening room. And you could see on Grasshopper's face, his confidence was draining by the second. Get on to the end of the plank, Grasshopper. And you could tell by his body language, Grasshopper did not want to go on to that plank. But he had to. Now, Grasshopper, walk! And little Grasshopper looked at looked to his master. Please, please, no. Walk! And so Grasshopper started walking over the pool of concentrated acid, and he could look down and see the bones, the human bones of people who hadn't made it. And all of that confidence drained. This ability to walk across the plank in the courtyard was useless when it was over a pool of acid. You could see him start to shake and then to wobble. And as he got closer to the middle of the pool of acid, you could see his knees start to give way. He was losing his balance and he started to sway so precariously it looked like he was going to fall in. And then... They had the adverts, the commercials. I was so upset that these TV programs had to stop for the ads, and the stupid ads as well. I want to find out what was happening to my friend, little grasshopper. How is he going to survive? And apparently they still have those adverts these days on TVs, do they? Or is it in the middle, the most important moment? No, they wouldn't torture me like that. I will never watch that TV channel again. No, it wasn't the end of the episode. It was a commercial break, only 5 minutes, but it felt like half an hour. But eventually we were back again into this. And as always, I think they still do this, they go back a couple of seconds. So, you know, to this point where they left off, you know, a little bit of a rerun. And so you saw him just in a, you know, quarter of a way across. Start to be a bit unsteady, start to wobble a bit, start to sway. And he got to the point he was about to fall in. I thought, what's going to happen? And he fell in. He fell into the pool of acid. And I, oh my God, what's going to happen to my friend? And the master, the great compassionate monk, was laughing his head off. What sort of compassion is that? And little grasshopper was splashing around. And I noticed, and grasshopper noticed about the same time, it wasn't hurting, it wasn't burning. And that's when the master stopped laughing and said, it's not acid, grasshopper, it's only water. We threw the bones down there for special effects. And then when grasshopper and I were trying to figure out what was the purpose of this lie, this deceit, he said, grasshopper, why did you fall in when for a week you've been able to walk across the same size plank in the courtyard without falling off once? Why did you fall in? Fear pushed you in, little grasshopper. Only fear. And I thought, what a wonderful teaching that was. Fear makes you fall in. Nothing else. Fear makes you fail. Fear breaks up your relationship. Fear stops you being happy. Only fear. Nothing more. Wow, what a great teaching that was. And that's one of the reasons why I decided I'm not going to be afraid of anything. Be fearless, nothing to lose. That's why I got nothing. You got nothing to lose. So, a lot of times people keep telling me, just giving public talks. That's the most frightening thing to do. Why? I'm not afraid when I give talks. That's my life these days. Actually, sometimes if I have a free evening, which is very rare when I don't give a talk, I'm pretty sure I talk in my sleep. This is just what I get used to. But if ever you're giving a talk in public, presenting to your company, giving a talk to someone, which we all have to do these days, why do you stuff up? Fear. Only fear stops you talking. Some of the young monks, you know, when they gave their first talk, said, look, you can talk to me for hours. You don't feel afraid. It's just the same here. Stand up, sit up here and just talk to your friends. That's all it is. You relax, you're not afraid. And then something beautiful happens. You can communicate to people. So fear is the problem. Why? Fear of failure. Fear of what people will think about you. Fear of blame and criticism. For goodness sake, no matter what you do, you'll always get criticized. Even if you're the most perfect person in the whole world, you'll always get criticized. So whatever I do, I'm going to get criticized. So I don't give a damn. I'm going to do what I like. You can criticize me anyway. So I get a lot of criticism, but I don't mind. Because I know that you can't avoid that. That's part of life. So that means you can mess up, stuff up. And I realized this. I was logical. I was a scientist, you know, trained at Cambridge. I thought to myself, look, if you stuff up giving talks, brilliant. Great. Then I can just stay in my monastery and meditate all day. It'd be wonderful. People said, because, you know, there was actually a few people from Korea at the nuns' retreat, perhaps this sniffle is the start of MERS. Are you afraid? So I use that. So I'm a bit tired. So remember, this could be MERS. So after the talk is finished, no questions, please. That means I can go back to bed early. Using my phone. Because I wanted to go to South Korea and it's now been cancelled. And people said, oh, are you afraid? I said, of course I'm not afraid. I don't run by fear. I always see the positive in things. I told people over in Singapore last night, I gave a talk there. And I said, look, I thought I was still going to South Korea. If I go to South Korea, and I come back through Perth Airport, and they say, you've been in Korea, you better go to quarantine. And they find I've got something. Wonderful. Quarantine is just like a meditation retreat. You really get looked after, nice beds, no one to talk to you, you can't come and ask me the questions. Cecilia can't sort of get me to get involved in the conference and the Buddhist Society, and people overseas can't invite me. I've got a good excuse to say, sorry, I can't go, I'm in quarantine. Oh, what a beautiful rest that would be. You always see the positive side of things, which means you don't have fear. Fear is always thinking something might go wrong. That's one of the other little sayings I have. In that book, Don't Worry, Be Grumpy, I wanted to go for Don't Worry, Be Hopey. That's one of my sayings. Don't worry, be hopey. It's a brilliant little thing you can actually, one-liner, which changes your whole life. What it means, what is worry anyway? What is fear? Fear is looking to the future and thinking about all the things which will go wrong. That's what it is. A negative attitude towards the future. Fear, that's anxiety. It's going to go wrong, it's going to go wrong, it's going to go wrong. And that creates the wrong. So if you worry about things, you create failures and problems and difficulties. Ask any psychologists. You don't ask a psychologist, ask yourself. You've been there, done that. So don't worry, be hopey. Hope is looking at the future and with a positive mind, all the things which might go right. So you've got a choice. You're looking at the future. If you are one who plans for the future, looks for the future, I've been trying to tell you not to do that, but you're so disobedient disciples, I go to plan B. If you can't live in the present moment, you're going to think about the future. At least think about the future with a positive mind. Be hopey, which is the opposite of worry. Don't worry, do the opposite. Look at the future with a positive mind. And this is not being stupid. It's not being irrational. It's not being sort of crazy. If you look at the future with hope, you create a far greater probability of positive outcomes. This is not even psychology. This is quantum physics. I keep on mentioning this. People create the future, or they create the present, actually, by how they perceive this moment. The observation collapses the Schrödinger equation to create reality as we know it. And because your observation, literally not just seeing, but the way you see it, creates reality, that is fundamental theoretical physics. This is hard science. Some scientists would object to me that I'm interpreting a little bit, but this is how I understand a basic principle of quantum science. What you create, your ability to create, is enormous. We don't realize that, so we don't employ it. Actually, we don't sort of use it, so we allow ourselves to be negative. We create negative outcomes. We create our world. So don't worry, be hopey. Is a powerful teaching. It means you do create a better outcomes in the future. Now, when we have that hope, we don't have fear. When we don't have fear, we don't have control. Fear, negativity, worry, control all come together. And that is a terrible way to live. You know that in relationships, when one partner is controlling you. In a family, when you've got a dominant person there controlling you. In a country, like a dictatorship, where someone is controlling everybody. That is just, that stunts, it suppresses happiness, joy, progress, creativity. If you want to have a creative environment, you don't control things. That's another thing which I learned at Cambridge, that any suggestion I had, or any other student had, even the most stupid ideas, they would never be suppressed. So I'll give it a try, see what happens. And I was really impressed by that. You had an idea, some equation or some physics experiment, so give it a try, do it, see what happens. They never said, that's a silly idea, it won't work, stop it. That negativity was never there. In fact, it was encouraged, give it a try. 1,000 ideas would be stupid. They wouldn't work at all. But one of those thousands was where you got the Nobel Prize, where you got a big advance in the understanding of science, medicine, or whatever. Crazy ideas which were not repressed because there was no sense of control or fear, no fear of failure. Give it a try. Why one, I should always remember this, one big businessman who's quite famous, but I forgot his name because I don't know these names. I don't follow the news on the TV or stuff. But he once told me, I went to this really prestigious conference. I get into some really good gigs as a monk. If you really want to have an interesting lifestyle, become a monk or a nun. Honestly, the things I get up to as a monk or a nun, you know, it's I was an honorary nun. I was an honorary nun over in sort of Jogjakarta. But I got this invite once to go to Hayman Island, which is this really six-star resort. You have to be incredibly wealthy to go to those places for a leadership conference with Kevin Rudd, Julia Gillard, Brumby was there, Anna Bligh was there, and all these big business leaders were there. And that was, you know, when Kevin Rudd was prime minister. Wow. All expenses paid, seeing all these big shots. And that was an incredibly powerful conference, actually, to go to. You know, with all these, because what they were doing, they were trying to get new ideas. And that's why they invited me. Out of the box, new ideas, anything goes, give it a try. But one of the people I remember on the way back on the chartered aircraft was actually saying to me, he said, we don't call it failure anymore. We call it forward failing. I thought it was a brilliant idea, and that's one of the things I got back. Forward failure, you give it a try. You're not afraid to give something a try. It doesn't work out, but you've gained a lot from that. You're not afraid, which means you don't control, which means you have this beautiful flowering. When I was over in that, there's an article in the Bangkok Post, I think, about business stuff, which Cecilia was mentioning. There I just mentioned in this conversation with these business leaders in Bangkok, CEOs, that they, it's like the idea of let 1,000 flowers bloom. And I never really understood that simile. And they started explaining to me what it means, 1,000 flowers bloom. Throw the seeds everywhere. Millions of seeds, billions of seeds. Most of those won't flower. But if you think like that, you will never throw those seeds out, and 1,000 flowers will never bloom. This is the idea of don't stunt yourself. Give it a try. If you fail, it's forward failing. But some of those things will change the whole nature of this world. Go for it. That sort of positive, no fear, means you don't control, repress, stop things. It's beautiful flowering of creativity. Give it a try. Why not? Who knows? See what happens. That's like me being a monk. Give it a try. Who knows? What might happen? Now look where I am. Big trouble. But having a wonderful life. But when you control, you create so much suffering for yourself. I never control the talks. I just let it flow. You know, this talk this evening, I didn't know what I was going to talk about again, like usual, till about 15 minutes before when somebody actually mentioned this. I thought, oh, that's a good idea for a talk. And controlling. So I don't even control the talks, which is maybe one of the reasons why they're popular, why they go all over the world, or why, unfortunately, I'm a rock star in Indonesia. And I mean this. It's just my life. And I don't want to be a rock star. I'm supposed to be a monk. I went over to this small town of Magelang, just, you know, north of Yogyakarta. They wanted me to give a talk there. 5,000 people came. And I was mobbed. And by Muslims, mostly, and Christians. What the heck's going on in this world? But, you know, that's not pleasant. Because you have to have photographs taken, people asking you questions, signing books, hour after hour after hour, especially photographs. Flash, 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 flash. For 5 minutes, that's okay. But for 2 or 3 hours, that's crazy stuff. And I thought that was all over when I went to the nuns' conference. They wanted photographs of me as well. It's crazy stuff. What do you want to? I'm an old, fat monk. What do you want a photograph of me for goodness sake? And there was a time, about a year or two ago, I decided I'm going to control that. No more photographs. Because I heard that Borobudur, you know, next to Yogyakarta, people were taking so many photographs of this ancient monument, Borobudur, that the stone was degrading. So, yeah, you're degrading me, all these flash photographs. But you realize, if I try to control that, I just have so much suffering. If I try to hide, run away, and say, I'm not doing it, I'm tired, I'm sick, I'm not going to do this, you create so much stress. That is a pain. It takes away the joy of life. So the reason why, I don't know, but people got so much fun, me messing around, taking photographs. Over there, with the nuns, these are bhikkhunis from all parts of the world. It's really inspiring to see just how women's Buddhism is taking off. It wasn't there when I started as a monk. It's huge now. All these bhikkhunis from all over the world. Now, Tenzin Palmo was there, Thubten Chodron, Dhammananda, all these big stars of women's Buddhism all coming together. They don't care. They don't give a damn what sect of Buddhism they are. And all just hanging out together and just getting women's Buddhism really, really strong over there. It was really wonderful. And so I had all these photographs. And because, you know, Buddhism, put your hands up like this. I get fed up with, please excuse me, for I'm going to offend a few people, putting your hand up all the time. So with the nuns, I said, look, I'm an Australian monk. Sort of, instead of doing this Anjali, it's called, do the Australian form of Anjali. Kangaroo. So all these photographs with all these senior nuns, like Tenzin Palmo, in the kangaroo pose. Why not? I get fed up with doing this, so have a bit of fun again. It's much better than, you know, rabbit ears. So a little bit of fun in games like that. It's not controlling, creativity, no fear. See what happens. Yeah, sometimes you get some criticism. I have to deal with that. Some people say, oh, yeah, you went a bit too far that time. Okay, I admit that. The joke went a bit too far. But, you know, that's how I learn. I'm not afraid of making mistakes. Not afraid of innovating. Not afraid of doing things in a different way. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But that is life now. If you're under control, you're not alive. If you get rid of your fear, no control, just let it evolve. See what happens. No fear of the future. Be hopey. Don't worry. Then you find your life really takes off. I haven't mentioned meditation. It's so important. Control freaks in meditation. Oh my God, that really makes me really sad. People try and control their minds. And if you've been trying to do that, those overseas, listen to this online. If you are control freak in meditation, yeah, you can sit for many hours in meditation. Ajahn Chah called that chicken meditation. Because he told me chickens can sit on the eggs for 5 or 6 hours without moving, and they do not get enlightened. So just sitting still is not the point. The point is just what's going on inside that physical stillness. Is your mindset, are you controlling? And there's too many people even meditate with so much control. Why? Fear. Afraid. And the whole point of this meditation is letting go of that fear. Relaxing, letting go. And then if you try and control, you can't last very long. You get so tense and tight and sick and you get angry afterwards. Some people tell me this. My husband came home from a meditation retreat, not this meditation, other types, and they're worse than when they went. More angry, more stressed, more tense. What the heck is going on? That's not meditation. Relaxes you, no fear. Imagine having a life without fear. I mean, I don't mean like stupid, like just walking in front of a bus. I'm not afraid of dying. I mean, just the usual stuff of fear, you know, the stupid fears. A life without those stupid fears. Imagine what it would be like, being so free and happy as well. And inventive, creative, interesting. Control, I say, is like you have a book, a novel to read, and you want to find out who did it, so you read the last page first. That's called control. So no, just let the novel of your life just evolve. Be hopey. Just see what happens on the next page, but don't go too far ahead. And if you can do that, you understand the beauty of life, the freedom of life. And then you're far more successful, far more healthy, far more happy. When you control, you're going to be in big problems. And you're going to be one of those other terrible people we have in this world, the control freaks. You know what I mean. You've met too many of them. And you know that, to a certain extent, you're one of those control freaks. Let it go. Learn how to relax. Learn how to be peaceful. Be kind. And you find in life, as in meditation, you bliss out. Especially in meditation. All the control in meditation, which I did in my young years, was such a waste of time. You let go, sit down, see what happens. Then you get blissed out of your heads. Third noble truth, the way to enlightenment is letting go of all wanting, all control. Let go. Great teaching of the Buddha. Now you know how to have a happy life. At least you may not get all the way, but please don't control your kids so much. Love them without controlling them. And your poor partner, please love them. Don't control them. Don't be afraid of them. Trust them. And yeah, they get into trouble. You get into trouble, but this is how we learn. Mistakes are part of life. Don't be afraid of making mistakes. And then you don't make so many. Be afraid of making mistakes is control. And then we make heaps. Just like a little grasshopper. Fear pushes you in to the water, makes you lose the path. Only fear, nothing else. Thank you for listening. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Okay, we've got some questions here from overseas. What is this one? Today, from Malta again. I think that was last time. Canada and Uruguay. That's really nice. So we've got from Europe, from North America and South America. First of all, if fear tends to have such harmful effects, then when is it useful? Okay, now we have this, we fear too much. There's some things, again, fearing a fire. You know, you don't say, oh, it's only burning, or crossing a road. You have to be vigilant and not be stupid. But most things people fear, that is way too much, and it causes us too much problems, and it causes control, which is the main part of this talk. Not fear so much, but control. When is it useful? It's actually maybe 10% of the time you feel afraid. Maybe 5%. 90% of the times you're afraid, it's not useful. So see if you can actually scale back your fear. And you'll find that your life goes much better. To give up all your fear straight away is asking too much of you. But at least you can scale it back. Be a bit more courageous in life, in relationships. Trust. And be open to the uncertainty of the future. And you'll be able to handle it so you don't need to control it. Let it just unfold. From Canada. I'm beginner to meditation, I've done very little. What can I do to prepare for an upcoming 9-day retreat? Don't prepare at all. Learn how to not be a control freak. Preparing is being a control freak. Let it go. Just be in the present moment. Have fun. Make peace. Be kind. Be gentle right now from Canada. Right now. Stop worrying about the future. Then when you go on your 9-day retreat, you won't be worrying. How many more days are there to go? What am I going to do? How am I going to last? How many hours to lunch? How many minutes before I can go to bed? That destroys meditation. Preparing for something which hasn't happened yet. Please remember from Canada, as I say, I didn't say it this week, amazing. In the meditation, now is the only time you can do anything for your future. Right now. So if you want to prepare for your upcoming 9-day retreat, right now, in this moment, make peace, be kind, be gentle. That's the best you can do for future. Right now. Not sitting, exercising. It's actually learning how to be in the moment and not being afraid. That's the best thing to do. Dear Ajahn, sometimes I think I have a responsibility. Then I realize I'm just seeking control. How do I differentiate them? People these days are far too responsible. I want to start a society. Irresponsibility Anonymous or something. Or the Irresponsibility Club, where people can be irresponsible. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have one day a year when you're irresponsible? And you don't have no duties, no sort of, you can do whatever you want. And imagine doing that. No responsibilities for one day. Nothing to do, nowhere to go. We actually can do that. We have irresponsibility retreats at Jhana Grove. They're called Ajahn Brahm meditation retreats. We can be totally irresponsible. You can't get a good mobile phone message there, so you can't actually get contacted by your boss or by your husband or your kids or parents or something. No one can get to you. All your responsibilities are taken away from you. You can't do anything. You can't be responsible. And look, whenever I go overseas, I never take Buddhist Society of Western Australia with me, nor Bodhinyana Monastery, nor the Dhammasara Nuns Monastery. They can't fit in my bag. This is actually all I take overseas. I can't fit it in there. So I leave it in Perth. I am a very irresponsible monk. Which what I mean is, when I'm there, I give it everything I've got, but then I can leave it afterwards. Sometimes we're in the prison of our responsibilities. It is the bars which confine us. I don't mean you don't care. Be compassionate, be kind, be reliable, trustworthy, but don't be responsible. Buddhist Society of Western Australia is not my baby. Even I'm the spiritual director. It is our baby. I'm not responsible for it. We are. Now, if you change your attitude like that, a lot of what you are imprisoned by fades away. Okay, very good. Thank you again from overseas. Any questions from here? Oh, okay, go on. I thought I'd get away. I'm not going to be responsible for my answer.
I just remember Krishnamurti was giving a teaching once in a large auditorium, and there was a person who was up in the loft somewhere, and Krishnamurti was talking about fear and being free of fear, and a man stood up in the loft and said, if I didn't have fear, what would stop me from jumping from this loft? Fear stops me. And he said, that, sir, is not fear, that's intelligence. So we don't really need fear to operate, I don't think.
Yeah, just need, but sometimes it really is it fear. Who knows? Now, by jumping from the balcony, who knows what might happen? Now, I shouldn't say that, because sometimes some people might actually do that because they Ajahn Brahm says. Now, that may be not the best simile, but there's so much things we say that intelligence can be confused with knowledge and learning. And this is one of these sayings, never allow that knowledge and learning to stand in the way of truth. And also innovation. Because our knowledge and learning says this is impossible, it can't be done. But then, when we're free of that fear of failure, it can be done. Our knowledge and learning is sometimes confused as intelligence. And it hinders us. We've learnt. This in Asia, many people have learnt women can't become full Buddhist nuns, bhikkhunis. They've learnt that. Standing in the way of progress. Learning what you've been told. Culture is sometimes not intelligence. And it's only going past that fear of the new, the strange, which stops us being free. Just like, I should have said this simile, because it fits in a nice place to stop. A prisoner who's been in jail for 40 years is afraid of freedom, would rather stay in jail and be controlled. It's a dangerous but liberating to actually be free of fear. We all know outside of prison is far better, but sometimes we make our prisons. We're comfortable there. And our fear, the fear of what we haven't seen and understood, stops us from being free. Da, da, da. Okay, that's a good question. Thank you for that. Okay, so now let's finish off by paying respects to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And remember, I have a cold, and it could be MERS, I'm not sure. So if you have a question to ask afterwards, it has to be really important, because I just came back this afternoon, long trip, so please leave me alone. It's not going to work, I bet.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.